Thank y'all. Thanks for coming and for listening for a while. What I plan to do, I've just finished writing this book, and I've worked on it for almost 2 years. There was a ton of research and a lot of writing, and I could talk about it for hours. It is a truly a compelling and fascinating story. So what I'm going to do is just ramble for a while. What, about an hour maybe? And when I run out of gas or get lost, I'll just
45 minutes,
okay, have some questions. Okay. I'd like to read a small section from the book that happens at the very end, and then we'll have some questions, and then we'll talk. And so, I mean, I have no notes, so if I get sidetracked, you probably won't know it. I copied some photographs, one photograph of Ron Williamson. Are we passing those around? I didn't bring enough for everybody. We got them? Okay. Pass those around. So you'll see who I'm talking about. This was a guy that I got to know after he died very well. I'm often asked, you know, where do you find stories, ideas for stories? And obviously it all goes back to the law and being a lawyer and the practice of law, which I did for only 10 years before I started writing. But all of my stories go back to, you know, watching lawyers in trials and trends in litigation, and I'm always thinking of, you know, really good courtroom dramas or juicy tales of legal intrigue or whatever. And I'm always amazed when students like, you know, you guys catch me somewhere and say, Mr. Grisham, thanks, you inspired me to go to law school. That was not the plan. I didn't mean to do that. And my own son now is a first-year law student at Ole Miss, so I'm in shock that he wanted to become a lawyer. This book started off innocently enough. I wasn't looking for a story. It was December 2004, December the 9th, to be exact, 2004. And I was flipping through the New York Times in a hurry one morning, and I came to the obituaries. And I love obituaries, especially New York Times obituaries, because they're very well written. There's actually a book about New York Times obituaries. You can buy the book and read about it, all the dead folks you want to read about. And I get a lot of names from local obituaries, if you look at the local newspapers, because then they print the entire name. And some of the names are just, you know, priceless. And the people are dead, and they can't sue you if you steal their name. So I get a lot of names from obituaries. But there was this, the lead obituary, the big obituary on December the 9th, 2004, was a picture of Ron Williamson. And he was standing in court the day he was exonerated, April 15th of 1999. And he just died. It took him 5 years to drink himself to death. But on this day, he was walking out of prison after 12 years. And he, as he stood in the courtroom, he was about to be released. And he had this odd look on his face. He was sort of smug and confused and obviously very elated. And the headline read, Ronald Williamson, freed from death row, dies at the age of 51. He and I were the same age. The first paragraph read, Ronald Keith Williamson, who left his small town in Oklahoma to become a Major League Baseball player, but was later sent to death row and came within 5 days of being executed for a murder he did not commit, died on Sunday in a nursing home near Tulsa. The cause was cirrhosis of the liver. He gave his sister's name. And the opening paragraph and photograph were compelling enough. But I read the entire obituary. And when I got finished with it, I knew it had the clear makings of a much longer story. And I immediately called his sister, the one listed in the obituary. He left no wife and no children. Her name was Annette, and she lived in Tulsa. And I called her and I said, hey, this is John Grisham, and I want to write this story. It took, you know, about 10 minutes to convince her it wasn't a crank phone call, and I really wanted to write this story. And within a couple of hours, we had a deal over the phone, and I plunged into this story that I still am losing sleep over. So I'll tell you a little bit about Ron Williamson. Once I began doing research into the guy, I realized that the obituary hardly scratched the surface. He grew up in a small town in Oklahoma called Ada, Oklahoma, about 15,000 people, about 90 miles southeast of Oklahoma City. I grew up in a small town in Arkansas. He and I were born about the same time. I dreamed of playing professional baseball, as did most kids. He did too, except he had the tools. He was a great high school baseball player and a great high school basketball player. And many people, the older he got, more and more scouts sort of whispered that this guy could be the next Mickey Mantle. And when you grew up in the 60s, Mickey Mantle was a god, but especially in Oklahoma, because that's where he was from the small town of Commerce, Oklahoma. And every kid in Oklahoma dreamed of being the next Mickey Mantle. Ron Williamson thought that he was that player. He turned down offers to play baseball in college and also basketball. And in the free agent draft in 1971, he was the first player drafted out of the state of Oklahoma. I think the 42nd player picked overall. He was drafted by the Oakland A's. And for those of you who are baseball historians or remember the Oakland A's, I'm showing my age here. In 1970, the Oakland A's were the first team with the long hair and the mustaches and the fancy uniforms, the cocky California attitudes, and it was the wrong team for Ron Williamson to go play for. He signed a bonus of $50,000, which nowadays does not look like much, but it was a big bonus back then, and went off to pursue his dream, and everybody thought he was on the fast track. He never got close. He had some injuries in the minor leagues. He was traded to the Yankees as a minor leaguer. The photograph you see going around is his final year in baseball, 1977, when he's 25 years old. He didn't take care of himself. He picked up a lot of bad habits, a lot of booze, a lot of drugs, a lot of women, a lot of partying, a lot of late-night stuff that's pretty typical in minor league baseball. At the age of 25, he got cut for the last time by the Yankees and went back to his hometown of Oklahoma, and he could never accept the fact that he didn't make it. No star dims faster than that of a high school athlete, a great star, and Ron could not accept the fact that he just didn't make it. He thought the town was counting on him, and he let them down. They didn't know it then, but he was manic depressive, and he was diagnosed as being bipolar when he was about 25 years old. The records aren't real clear. He begins showing signs of mental illness. He was given some medications and wouldn't take them. He did a lot of self-medicating with booze and drugs. And things spiraled out of control. He couldn't keep a job. He couldn't keep a schedule. He moved back in with his mother, and he would sleep on the sofa, her little small house there in Ada, sometimes 20 hours a day. He would not walk into his own bedroom. He had a shrine, still had a shrine to Mickey Mantle in his bedroom with his gloves and baseball cards and all this stuff. And he was afraid to go in there because, for some reason, he began hearing voices. Then he began answering the voices. At the age of 28, 29, his life was a mess. He pretty much gave up. At about that time, in December of 1982, in the small town of Ada, in one of the honky-tonks that Ron went to all the time, a young waitress left work that night and went to her apartment. They found her the next morning. She had been brutally raped and strangled and murdered. And she was 21 years old. The police were, being gratuitous here, untrained and just basically corrupt. The last person seen alive with the victim was never treated seriously as a suspect. And there was all sorts of suspicion around. He was a local thug. The cops knew him well. And the victim actually knew him, too. They went to high school together. But the cops didn't pursue him. And we found out 15 years later why. At the time, he was selling drugs with a lot of the local cops. And they covered up for the guy. For 5 years, the police could not solve the crime. They just didn't have enough evidence. This was before DNA. There was some hair found at the scene, scalp hair and pubic hair, found on the bedding, in a towel that was stuffed down the victim's throat. And they had hair evidence. And hair evidence has sent more innocent people to prison than, I guess, eyewitness identification. Eyewitness identification is probably the most inaccurate of all types of evidence. But hair is just horrible, and it was known to be bad and unreliable 100 years ago. But the police and the prosecutors and the courts, in their desire to solve unsolved crimes, many years ago sanctioned the use of hair evidence. And because the cops had some hair evidence, they finally found the right analyst with the state crime lab who could pin some of the hair on Ron Williamson. 5 years after the murder, when Ron Williamson was diagnosed as severely depressed, bipolar, and schizophrenic, and untreated and unmedicated, he was arrested and charged with capital murder. At the time, this small town in Oklahoma, small county, did not have a public defender system, which is still true in a lot of rural counties. The county I practiced in, I started practicing law 25 years ago, did not have a full-time PD's office. And we had kind of a rotating plan whereby all the rookies fresh out of law school would take the indigent defense cases because the older lawyers had done that when they were rookies. And if you wanted some trial work, and I wanted trial work, I took a lot of indigent cases, and including murder cases, because I wanted to get in the courtroom. Well, it was the same way in this county. But nobody would touch this capital murder case. But the cops were convinced for years that Ron Williamson was the murderer. The prosecutor was convinced within 2 months of the murder that Ron Williamson was the murderer. They had been convinced for 5 years. They just couldn't put the crime together. But they finally made an arrest. Once they got him in jail, they began using their favorite investigatory tool, snitches. They would put another criminal in the cell with him. And they'd become buddies, and then after about 2 or 3 days, they'd pull that snitch out. He'd go to the police and say, well, this guy made a full confession. I'm ready to testify. Let's cut a plea deal, and I'll walk out of here, and I'll be your star witness. That's the way snitches operate. And with snitches, they begin putting together the case against Ron Williamson. His lawyer, court-appointed, because nobody else would take the case, was blind. He was a very good lawyer. He was blinded in a high school chemistry accident when he was 16 years old. He finished high school, finished college, was a good student in law school, a real local character, loved to drink whiskey and chase women. His goal, Barney Ward is his name. Barney's no longer with us, so I can talk about him. I learned when you write real stuff, you really worry about getting sued. But if they're dead, they can't sue you, so I really went after the folks who are already dead. Barney's goal was to kill a deer. And every year, the other lawyers would take him to deer camp, which is nothing but a week-long, you know, festival of bourbon and dirty jokes and steaks and stews, and if there's any time left, they may go hunt a little bit. And they actually took Barney out in the woods one day, and they found a big deer, and they lined it up and gave Barney the gun real carefully and told him when to pull the trigger. And he almost killed the deer. But for years, he talked about killing this deer. He was a true character. Loved to play poker, but he had his own set of Braille cards. And with his Braille cards, he had to be the dealer. And when they lost all their money to Barney, they said, well, maybe somebody else can deal for a while. And his earnings went way down. But he loved women, loved secretaries. He was just a real character. In his younger days, he was a really effective courtroom lawyer. He could smell, with an extra sense, he could smell a weakness in a prosecution's case. He could rip a lying witness to shreds. Paperwork, though, was not his specialty. And even though he always had an assistant with him, in any trial, they would be passing around the photographs, crime scene photographs, and Barney would growl, "Let me see the damn photographs." Well, it was an unwritten rule in this small courtroom. They would just call timeout. Barney would step outside with his assistant, and they were all named Linda for some reason. He liked the ones named Linda. Went through a bunch of Lindas, and Linda would describe in detail the photograph. And Barney could picture it, and he'd go back in, and he would object to half of them and argue. He had a great memory, a great mind. That was when he was young. By the time he met Ron Williamson, he was a bit past his prime. He had stopped drinking, which local rumor has it he had to change. He also had to use seeing-eye dogs, and he had to get rid of one dog when he stopped drinking because the dog kept going to the liquor store, and they... They couldn't break the dog from going to the liquor store. Another bit of local lore was that one liquor store actually closed when Barney went on the wagon. But he was an older man, and he would sit in court with these big, thick sunglasses on, the wraparound style. And the local gossip was you didn't gossip in court because Barney heard everything. But the lawyers knew if you could get past lunch and on into the afternoon when it was nap time, Barney would go to sleep. And if you could get to 3 o'clock, you could usually beat him. So they would stall around forever until late in the afternoon, and Barney would lose the case. The judge asked Barney if he would represent Ron Williamson. And at the time, as an indigent client, at the time, Ron's family was fairly pleased with that decision because Barney had a reputation. At the time, Ron Williamson was in jail, in the county jail, which is next to the courthouse, unmedicated and rapidly losing what sense he had left. He would scream for hours, and there's a small jail. It's a bunker jail with no windows and really a strange way to build a jail, but he would scream for hours that he was innocent and go on and all night long. The guards finally complained so much to Barney. Barney got a prescription for Thorazine, and the jailers would actually nuke him with a strong dose of Thorazine. It would knock him out. And if Ron had to go to court, they would cut back on the drugs, and he would kind of act like himself, really unstable. But as soon as he got to jail, they would juice him up, and he'd maybe go to sleep, and everybody else could sleep too. And the first few times Barney met with Ron, they never got along. Ron was, at one time, he was almost in a coma. So Barney started adjusting the medications too. So he had the jailer and the lawyer dispensing the drugs to a man who was very seriously mentally ill. The proof that they came up with, they kept adding to their proof. The preliminary hearing did not go well because they didn't have enough proof. So they found another snitch. They found somebody else who was willing to testify. They'd heard Ron say something about the case in jail. And this is the way they built this ridiculous case against this guy. After a year, it went to trial. And during his trial, Ron was, the medications were really being adjusted. The good drugs he hadn't had in years, the stuff he needed. The Thorazine would kind of come and go. But in trial, he was a wild man. When they brought in these lying witnesses, he would, at one time, jumped up, knocked over a table. The table hit Barney, knocked Barney on the floor, and Linda went with him. And there was this huge brawl in the floor in front of the jury. And the trial was just a fiasco. And several times Ron would scream at the witnesses, you know, stop lying. You're lying. Stop that lying. Judge, make them stop lying. They're telling lies on me. And he was being truthful, but he was doing it in such a way it scared everybody. The jurors were terrified of him. He was a big guy, big athletic guy, and cocky and all that kind of stuff. I found out later, I didn't put this in the book, I found out too late. And I dread publication because once a book comes out, I'm going to hear all these wonderful stories nobody would tell me before I was published the book. The jurors actually kept in touch with each other for a number of years after the trial because they were so scared of him. They were afraid he might get out one day. They had no trouble convicting him. By then, Barney had pretty much quit the defense. Right before the trial, Barney had talked the judge into having co-counsel to look at the photographs, to look at the hair analysis, to look at things that you really needed to see. And the judge had appointed co-counsel, and the co-counsel quit right before the trial. Barney also filed a motion to get some money to hire an expert to rebut the hair analysis. The judge denied that motion. So Ron was in the courtroom with Barney, who couldn't see the evidence. The jury was out about 2 hours and found him guilty. The jury was out. Barney inexplicably called no mitigating witnesses at the trial. And after a few hours, Ron Williamson was off to death row in July of 1988. Death row in Oklahoma is as bad as it gets. I've been to several of them around the country, and it is they're all bad. But it's really dreadful, especially the first place Ron went to. And it's bad enough when you're there and you've murdered five people, okay? But when you're there and you're completely innocent and you're mentally ill to begin with, everything unraveled in a hurry for Ron. They refused to treat him. Next to death row was a special needs unit where they have real psychiatrists and real drugs. They had a policy in Oklahoma back then they wouldn't treat death row inmates there, even if they were mentally ill, because the theory was they're dying anyway. The food was just pure slop. Ron lost 100 pounds in the first 6 months. And as his sister would visit him, she was convinced that he was going to die on his own. Oklahoma would not get the chance to kill him. He would, again, scream for hours. He was a very smart guy. He would read, he read all 2,000 pages of his trial transcript, and he could quote them, the ones he thought were important. He grew up in a really staunch Pentecostal church and knew hundreds of verses of Scripture. And he could even fancy himself as a preacher, and he would scream Scripture all through the night. There were several attempts on death row to kill him. Believe it or not, every death row has several leaders and little gangs, and you're not a real leader unless you're trying to kill somebody because you're on death row anyway. And so they'd always try to put, they try to make you pay rent to live on death row, and Ron told them where they could go with that. In Oklahoma, they lock them down for 23 hours a day. That's not unusual. There's no law that says you have to do that, but for the Oklahoma and most of the southern states, the ones that are the ones still fighting the war, they try to make it as harsh as possible. And so Oklahoma is about as harsh as it gets. He got 1 hour a day out into the yard, which is a kind of a play area where they would visit and sometimes play and sometimes fight. They would get three showers a week, 15 minutes each. Sometimes the water's cold, sometimes it's hot. It was never what it should be. You could shower alone or shower with a pal who would guard for you. Anyway, it's a lot of the book deals with the horrors of death row and what it did to a man who was very, very ill. His appeals progressed through Oklahoma. The Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals unanimously affirmed the conviction. They cited several small mistakes in the trial, but said the overwhelming evidence was there, and so they rubber-stamped it. He went to post-conviction relief in Oklahoma, and that was also just a formality. In 1994, after being on death row for 6 years, he entered the habeas corpus phase, and he got some good lawyers. Not that his other lawyers are bad. His appellate lawyers are actually pretty good. But he got a couple really good court-appointed indigent lawyers for his federal habeas work. And one lawyer in particular, a lady by the name of Janet Chesley, who is still there, wrote a brief for Ron Williamson. And the brief was so well written that when the death penalty clerk in the federal court's federal judge's office read it late one night, long after he should have been asleep. He was reading habeas corpus petitions. And he read this one, and the first page jumped up at him. And he read it throughout the night, went to the office the next morning, sat down with his boss, the federal judge, and he said, "I think we have a problem here." They had given Ron 30 days notice that he was going to die. They hauled him into the warden's office and said, "You know, really hate to tell you this, but in 30 days, it's all over. Here are a few formalities. Here are the rules regarding visitation. And, oh, by the way, what do you want us to do with your body?" And he said, "I don't know. I don't care. You know, just send me to my sister." His sister got a notice the next couple days that she could witness the execution, but she had to make funeral arrangements. This is really morbid procedure they go through, and they try to make it as painful as possible. They put Ron in a holding cell for 30 days, and Janet Chesley, his lawyer, went to see him and said, "Look, they're not going to execute you, okay? I'm going to stop it. I know I can get a stay, and we're going to have some more appeals, and I'm going to get you some help. But I'm not going to file it until the last minute, okay? That's the way we do things. I'm going to file it so late in the game that the federal judge has no choice but to grant a stay. and we'll take off to this 10th Circuit in Denver. And most of her clients understood that. Ron was unable to understand that. And he counted the days. For 30 days, he counted, and he screamed, and he prayed, and he pulled his hair out, and he was completely insane. With 5 days to go, the federal judge issued the stay and saved his life. And I got to go meet with the federal judge when I was doing my research, and it was fun sitting down with him because he's a real hero in the book. After Ron got his stay, the judge and his staff worked on the habeas petition for 12 months. And when Judge Frank C. issued his opinion a year later, September of 1995, it was 100 pages long, and it was just a masterpiece of judicial analysis and reasoning, and he threw the book at the trial lawyer, the prosecutor, the cops, the trial judge, the experts, the hair experts for the state. Judge C. in 1995 outlawed hair analysis forever in every courtroom. He couldn't do that, but he was upset. But he had never trusted hair evidence. He always knew how unreliable it was. But the opinion is just beautiful. And I quote some of it in the book. At the very end of his opinion, he added an epilogue. I've never seen an epilogue to an opinion before. But, you know, you're a federal judge. You can do what you want to. You got the job for life. It's not like they can vote you out of office. And Judge C. wrote, he said, "As I was considering this case, I told a friend of mine that I was going to have to order a new trial for a convicted murderer. And my friend said, 'Is he guilty?' And I said, 'I don't know. And we won't know until he has a fair trial.' And he went on to write, 'God help us in this country if we ever execute people who have not had fair trials.' That almost happened in this case. The case was sent back for a new trial. And then, after 7 years on death row, they finally moved Ron next door to the special needs unit where he got some good doctors and some good medications. And he sort of began the long road back to some level of mental stability. It took several years. That was 1995. He got a great lawyer in 1997 for his new trial. And the first thing his new lawyer did was have a competency hearing. And they haul Ron in from the mental hospital at death row to his county courthouse where he'd been convicted. And they put him on the stand, and his lawyer said, "Testify." And after about 5 minutes, there was no doubt that the poor man was as crazy as they come. And the judge said, "We're not about to have a trial until this man gets some help." That was 97. In 1998, Ron's case was discovered or picked up by Barry Scheck's Innocence Project group in New York. They arranged for DNA testing. And it took a little over a year to complete all the testing on the hair and the semen found in the victim. And in April the 15th of 1999, in the same courtroom, Ron Williamson was completely exonerated. And one of the same witnesses who had testified as a hair expert against him testified as a DNA expert for him and said, "Judge, nothing matches. The hair doesn't match. The semen doesn't match." And in the middle of this hearing, very dramatically, it was great the way they did it, the judge says, "Well, oh, by the way, do you know who does match?" And this witness said, "Yes, it's Glenn Gore." And Glenn Gore was the last person seen with the victim the night she was murdered. Should have been the obvious suspect from day one. Gore is now on death row in Oklahoma, and I visited him last December briefly, and he will be there for the rest of his life. Ron, somehow, I don't watch a lot of television, and this case got a lot of coverage when it happened in 1999. It was one of the first big DNA exonerations, and Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld were all over the place, and it was just a Dateline, NBC, and Inside Edition, and Court TV, and all these shows wanted to do Ron Williamson, and he was very willing to go along with them. And 2 weeks after he was exonerated, April 29th of 1999, Good Morning America paid for Ron and his sister, Annette, and his lawyer, Mark Barrett, and a few others to come to New York to chat with Diane Sawyer. And there were three other exonerees from Oklahoma. They made the trip to four people on the set with Diane Sawyer. Of course, Ron immediately started hitting on Diane Sawyer. He was convinced she was in love with him. And while he was in New York, he wanted to do one thing, and that was to see Yankee Stadium. And I want to read a brief scene that takes place late in the book when Ron Williamson finally got to go to Yankee Stadium. This is chapter 16. This is the advanced reading copy, and it's just filled with mistakes. Did you notice that, Brandon? I don't know how they managed to do this. When a book comes out, it's got 20 mistakes in it anyway, after the proofreaders get through with it. They always blame the author for the typos, mistakes in the book, and it's just not fair because somebody else did it. Here is April 29th, 1999. Ron's been out of prison for 2 weeks. The daily rituals of Yankee Stadium vary slightly when the team is out of town. Without the urgency of crowds and cameras and without the expectation of another pristine playing surface, the old house creaks slowly to life so that by late morning the groundskeepers in their khaki shorts and ash t-shirts are tending the field at a languid pace. Grantley, the chief grass cutter, tinkers with a spider-like Toro mower, while Tommy, the clay specialist, packs and levels dirt behind home plate. Dan pushes a smaller mower across the thick bluegrass along the first baseline. Sprinklers erupt at orchestrated intervals around the outfield warning track. A tour guide huddles with a group behind the third base dugout and points to something in the distance, beyond the scoreboard. The 57,000 seats are empty. Sounds echo softly around the place. The muffled engine of a small mower, the laughter of a groundskeeper, the distant hissing of a spray washer cleaning seats in the upper deck, the four train rumbling by just beyond the right field wall, the pecking of a hammer near the press box. For those who maintain the house that Ruth built, the off days are cherished, wedged between the nostalgia of Yankee greatness and the promise of more to come. Some 25 years after he was expected to arrive, Ron Williamson stepped up from the bench in the Yankee dugout and onto the brown, crushed shell warning track that borders the field. He paused to take in the enormity of the stadium, to soak in the atmosphere of baseball's holiest shrine. It was a brilliantly blue, clear spring day. The air was light, the sun was high, the grass so flat and green it could have been a fine carpet. The sun warmed his pale skin. The smell of freshly cut grass reminded him of other fields, other games, and old dreams. He was wearing a Yankee cap, a souvenir from the front office, and because he was a celebrity at the moment in New York for a segment on Good Morning America with Diane Sawyer. He was wearing his only sports coat, the navy blazer Annette had hurriedly purchased 2 weeks earlier, and his only tie, his only pair of slacks. The shoes had changed, though. He'd lost interest in clothes. Though he'd once worked in a haberdashery and had offered ready opinions about what others wore, he didn't care now. 12 years of prison garb does that to you. Under the cap was a bowl-cut mess of bright gray hair, thick and disheveled. Ron was now 46, but looked much older. He adjusted the cap, then stepped onto the grass. He was 6 feet tall, and though his body showed the damage of 20 years of abuse and neglect, there were still hints of the great athlete. He strolled across foul territory, stepped over the dirt base path, and headed for the mound, where he stood for a moment and gazed up at the endless row of bright blue seats. He gently put his foot on the rubber, then shook his head. Don Larson had pitched the perfect game from this exact spot. Whitey Ford, one of his idols, had owned this mound. He looked over his left shoulder out to right field, where the wall seemed too close, where Roger Maris had placed so many fly balls just far enough to clear the fence. And far away in deep center, beyond the wall, he could see the monuments of the greatest Yankees. Mickey was out there. Mark Barrett stood at home plate, also wearing a Yankee cap, and wondered what his client was thinking. Release a man from prison where he'd spent 12 years for nothing, with no apologies because no one has the guts to admit wrongdoing, no farewells, just get the hell out of here and please go as quietly as possible. No compensation, no counseling, no letter from the governor or any other official, no citation for public service. 2 weeks later, he's in the midst of a media storm, and everybody wants a piece of him. Remarkably, Ron was holding no grudges. He was too busy soaking up the richness of his emancipation. The grudges would come later, long after the media went away. Barry Sheck was near the dugout, watching Ron and chatting with others. A diehard Yankee fan, he had made the phone calls that set up the special visit to the stadium. He was their host in New York for a few days. Photos were taken. A camera crew filmed Ron on the mound. Then the little tour continued along the first baseline, drifting slowly as their guide rambled on about this Yankee and that one. Ron knew many of the stats and stories. No baseball had ever been hit completely out of Yankee Stadium, the guide was saying, but Mantle got close. He bounced one off the facade in right center. Right up there, he said, as he pointed to the spot, about 535 feet from home plate. But the one in Washington was further, Ron said. It was 565 feet. The pitcher was Chuck Stobbs. The guide was very impressed. A few steps behind Ron was Annette, following along as always, sweating the details, making the tough decisions, cleaning up. She was not a baseball fan. At that moment, her primary concern was keeping her brother sober. He was sore at her because she had not allowed him to get drunk the night before. Their group included Dennis Fritz, Greg Wilhoit, Tim Durham. All four exonerees had appeared on Good Morning America. ABC was covering the expenses for the trip. Jim Dwyer was there from the New York Daily News. They stopped in center field on the warning track on the other side of Monument Park with large busts of Ruth and Gehrig, Mantle and DiMaggio, and dozens of other smaller plaques of greater Yankees. Before renovation, this little corner was near sacred ground. This little corner of near sacred ground had actually been in fair territory, the guide was saying. Ron stepped close to the bust of Mantle and read his short biography. He could still quote the career stats he had memorized as a child. Ron's last year as a Yankee had been in 1977 at Fort Lauderdale, Class A, about as far away from Monument Park as any serious ball player could get. 1977, Fort Lauderdale Yankees. Ron made 14 appearances, pitched 33 innings, won 2, lost 4, and got knocked around enough so the Yankees had no trouble cutting him when the season was over. It was amusing, Annette thought, all this attention. As a kid and as a teenager, Ronnie had craved the spotlight, had demanded it, and now 40 years later, cameras were recording every move. Enjoy the moment, she kept telling herself. A month earlier, he'd been locked up in a mental hospital, and they were not sure he would ever get out. They slowly made their way back to the Yankee dugout and killed some time there. As Ron absorbed the magic of the place for a few final minutes, he said to Mark Barrett, "I just got a taste of how much fun they were having up here." Mark nodded, but could think of nothing to say. "All I ever wanted to do was play baseball," Ron said. "It's the only fun I've ever had." He paused and looked around and then said, "You know, this all sort of washes over you after a while. What I really want is a cold beer." The drinking began in New York. Thank you.
You'll do a few questions?
Yeah,
We'll take a few questions.
Questions, anyone? Yes, in back.
It's kind of hard to put, put it in context of a national debate. The national debate is old and continuing, and I'm not sure how much is affected by, current politics. I'll give you my own personal opinions. The death penalty system as we currently have it is terribly broken. Even if you support the death penalty, you cannot support the current system. There are so many flaws in it. It is so unfair. And what I hope comes from this book, we've not had a clear-cut case in this country, a certain case. We know by DNA evidence that the wrong person has been executed. Texas sort of admitted a few months ago they got one wrong 20 years ago, but I don't think it was by DNA. They just kind of realized they got the wrong guy. What I loved about this story is that Ron came within 5 days of being executed. And the first clerk who read the brief, the federal clerk, the federal magistrate, and the federal judge all told me that if they had not granted the stay, he would have been executed. They probably would have raced. They would have raced off to the Tenth Circuit in Denver, but that was not a fail-safe appeal. They had lost inmates before the Tenth Circuit could rule, so it was not automatic that a stay was going to be issued. So Ron was a dead man, and he was completely innocent. And I hope that the book—that's my one hope with this book—that people read it and realize that this system we have is simply too unfair to continue. Sir.
What went into your decision to leave the full-time practice of law to write books?
The question is, why did I stop practicing law and start writing books? Money. it was not a decision. I didn't wake up one day and say, okay, I'm going to stop this and start this. I had only been out of law school about 3 years when I started writing A Time to Kill. Now, that took 3 years to write, and it was a secret little hobby. Nobody knew about it but my wife. And I got that book published, and it didn't sell. We couldn't give them away. My publisher at the time printed 5,000 hardback copies, and I bought 1,000 of those. I mean, I tried to sell out of the trunk of my car. I wish I had them all back. But I'd gotten a habit of writing, and so after working nonstop, I was practicing law. I was a member of the legislature in Mississippi, so I was involved in politics. And, my wife was having babies, so we had a lot of things going on. But I'd get up real early in the morning and write for a couple of hours. And, I did that for 3 years. It became a real habit. A Time to Kill was, a tough book to write, tough book to read, and a tough movie to watch. I mean, it's got some pretty raw stuff in it. And it took a lot. It just took a lot of energy. And I said, if I'm going to do this one more time, I'm going to write one more book, and it's going to be a naked stab at commercial fiction. I'm going to write something that is popular as I can make it. And if it works, good. If it doesn't, forget this. It's time for this hobby to be over. And so I said, I came up with a story about this law firm, and it took 2 years to write the firm. And when the firm arrived in New York, fall of 1989, there was no great stampede for it. It sort of languished in my agent's office for a few months, and I didn't know if it was going to get published. I didn't know if it was readable. I didn't know if it was commercially viable. And I got the biggest, luckiest break I got in my life. Somebody stole a copy of it from a publisher in New York. And a bootleg copy of the firm surfaced in Hollywood. And some clown made 25 copies of it and sent it to all the big studios. We didn't know anything about it. I had an agent in New York. He didn't know anything about it. This stuff happens all the time in Hollywood. I learned that lesson. And he got scared when some big studios started making offers. And so the first phone call I got was from my agent on a Sunday morning, which baffled me because they don't, you know, they don't work on Fridays or Saturdays, Sundays, August. They just take off all the time. Sunday morning, my agent calls and says, we just sold the film rights to the firm, to Paramount Pictures. And I said, well, what happened to the book rights? We didn't sell the book rights. Yeah, I thought it was going to be a book before it's a movie. And he said, no, we've sold something. This is big. And I said, well, okay, just for fun, how much money do we get? And he said, $600,000. At the time, my law firm checking account was overdrawn. And that was the moment I said, okay, I'm tired of being a lawyer. I'm going to be a writer. So that's a long-winded answer to your question. But it was a gradual process. But at one point, though, I said, you know, this is a whole lot more fun than practicing law. Yes, sir. What was it like meeting the real killer? I didn't really want to meet him. I mean, in Oklahoma, you can never touch a death row inmate. And it's really bad right before they execute them. You know, when their mothers are there and their wives and kids and all that, their last moment together, they keep them, they have to talk through a telephone, you know, plexiglass. So, I mean, I felt safe. But I was talking to some other, there were two death row inmates I talked to who went to death row in 1985. They were there when Ron Williamson got there. One roomed with him for a couple years, and they're still there 21 years later. I mean, Ron's come and gone and died, and they're still there, which is not unusual on death row. And I wanted to talk to those guys. Particularly, I wanted to talk to his roommate. And so we had a good visit. And while I was there, word got out that I was there, and so Glenn Gore, the real killer, asked if we could, you know, if we could chat. And I wanted to ask him one question, and I did. The prosecutor, who is the number one bad guy in this book, and he'll probably file the first lawsuit sometime in November. The book comes out in October. Actually went to the county jail to talk to Glenn Gore when Glenn Gore was in jail for other charges. He was always in jail. And he threatened Gore. He said, you better testify against Ron Williamson or I'm going to do this, this, and this. And I'd heard that story. And I wanted to ask Gore, did the prosecutor, who is still in office, by the way, did he come threaten you in jail? And Gore said, sure, I've always said that. Then Gore wanted to take a picture with me, so I stood up next to the plexiglass, and Gore's, you know, through the glass, and somebody took a photograph, and they say it's hanging on his wall and on death row. I don't know why he wanted a picture of me. When the book comes out, he's really not going to be pleased. But he's been convicted twice of the murder. Ron Williamson was walked out of prison in 1999. It took the prosecutor and the cops 4 years to convict Glenn Gore. It took him 2 years to even charge him. For the first 3 years Ron was out, he expected to be arrested again. The prosecutor said, he's not off the hook yet. We may refile charges. So after going through this nightmare, he kept reliving it. They finally convicted Gore in 2003, 4 years after Ron got out. His conviction was reversed last summer, and he was retried in June of this year. And I went and watched the trial. And it was really bizarre watching this. The book was almost finished, and I had, you know, done research forever. And I felt like I, you know, knew as much as anybody in the courtroom. But it was really bizarre watching Glenn Gore get tried for the murder 24 years later. And the victim's mother, I interviewed her several times, and she was very receptive. I was sitting very close to her as she sat through the fourth trial for the murder of her daughter. Question? Yes, sir.
Do you think, given the sort of changing political context of the death penalty and criminal justice, particularly the 24/7 media and criminal justice, that young lawyers, people like me, are being dissuaded from going into
you know, to fight for death row inmates or to take a critical look at the system, because we face criticism, we face a lot of other things. And if that's the case, what do we do about it other than try to follow?
The question is, do I think that young lawyers are being dissuaded from taking cases like this and doing this kind of work because of the intense spotlight? I don't think so. I would think you'd be encouraged to with a number of exonerations. And the one thing the research in this book taught me, there are a lot of innocent people in prison. I wish we could go back and at least re-examine all of those people who were sent to prison based on hair evidence. This is before DNA. You've got people who've been in prison for 20 and 30 years for murder charges based on hair evidence. And as far as I know, most states don't have an active plan to review those cases. Even if they could with DNA, you can't always. Some of the evidence is gone. There are a lot of people in prison who need help. And I would hope that young lawyers would be encouraged to help these people. There's some great documentaries out, these guys who served 19, 20, 25 years and walk out of prison, and they were innocent to begin with. And some will quite often move you to tears, but there one in particular, he said, for 18 years I was in prison and I had no lawyer. But once I got a lawyer, and it was a young lawyer in Barry Scheck's office, it was in the afternoon since movie, wasn't it? The one we saw last year. He said, once I had a lawyer, I had somebody on the outside who believed in my case and was actively, daily doing something trying to get me out. He said it saved my life. It saved my sanity. And I knew that I had hope. And that's what kept him going. And there are a lot of people. I've been in a lot of prisons. And there are a lot of, thank God for prisons, okay? There are a lot of folks who need to be locked away forever. But there are a lot of folks who have no business being there. Yes, ma'am. That's a great question. That was the biggest, that was the most important issue in granting, staying the execution and granting a new trial. It's hard, the book is hard to believe. In the same courtroom with the same judge, 2 years earlier, Ron had some other trouble with the law. In 1985, he walked in the courtroom, he cussed the judge, and he cussed the same prosecutor, and he tried to swing at the deputies. He was obviously a very sick man, 2 years earlier. And the judge finally said, this poor boy needs some help. They took him off to the state mental institution and said, he's incompetent, he can't stand trial. 2 years later, the same judge in the same courtroom never said a word, facing death now. They never raised the issue of competency. And Oklahoma has a statute, a pretty good statute. I think most states have them. It says the judge at any time in any criminal proceeding, if he thinks that competency is an issue, he can call time out and send everybody home and send the defendant off for testing. In fact, he's duty-bound to do that. And the prosecutor can also do it if he wants to. They never do. But, of course, the defense lawyer, any good defense lawyer would be screaming competency, and Barney was asleep. Barney thought he was just mean. He didn't, you know, Barney had known him for a long time, and he just thought he was, you know, too much booze, too much drugs, and he was just mean. But anyway, the competency was not raised at his trial, which is still impossible to believe.